Hello and welcome to Conversations from the ANF podcast. We're opening up our conversations to include anyone connected to the world of caring or parenting or working with children who have experienced adversity or have complex needs. In this episode, we speak to Megan, a foster carer who is moving to Sierra Leone to support the development of children's welfare with the communities there. The charity she has founded is called Hear Their Roar, and you can find details of the work that they do at heartheirroar.org. If you have a perspective or experience that you'd like to share in this space, please get in touch through the Facebook or Twitter page, or you can email us at andfpodcast@gmail.com.
Okay, hello. I'm Megan Tanner. I currently am a NVR, which is Nonviolent Resistance Parenting Consultant, and a foster carer, which actually today is my last day of foster caring. So, yes.
Wow. Are you resigning? Sorry.
Yes, I did. I resigned a month ago. Yeah. So today's the last day. And it's been 11 years, which have...
Crikey.
It's been a roller coaster. Great times and some learning curves, I think we can call them, I reckon. But amazing. But I'm also a charity founder of Hear Their Roar charity. And we're about to go to Sierra Leone to set up permanently in Kenema, an area in Sierra Leone. So that's what I do.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, we could go three different ways with this. So right? It's like stick a pin in the ground and just see which one. So can you tell me a little bit then, why did you become a foster carer? Because that seems like probably the start point.
Interesting. When I was 10, I knew I wanted to work in Africa. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. At the time, it was looking after baby elephants. And then nothing ever happened. I went to drama college, became an actress, worked as an actress in musical theatre for a decade, just over a decade. And then realised in my early 30s that I wanted to foster, because actually there was a point in my life where I might have gone into foster care myself.
Right.
So it's always something that I had an affiliation with. And I had then the time, a spare room, and the ability to do it. So I became a foster carer 2011-12.
I have lots of questions. so that you made that sound really easy. Oh, and so I became a foster
carer.
Oh, God, no. I was going to say, like, if you came to me, you know, someone who's, did you have childcare experience? All of the questions I'd want to ask, your financial situation, all of those questions.
Yeah.
So what was there sort of a skepticism about you becoming a...
Oh, completely. Carer? And I had no child experience as well. So I was a single carer, still am, don't have any children of my own. I knew I didn't want to look after younger children because I had no experience of that.
Yeah.
Whereas I had taught stage schools and things on Saturdays and stuff while I was at drama college and things. So I felt, to be honest, I was arrogant. I believe that a couple of hours on a Saturday gave me enough knowledge about teenagers to be able to wisely parent them. I was wrong. You have to do 6 months of a Form F where they go into everything about you. I actually, at the end of it, my first foster child, I emailed the lady who took my Form F and apologized for my incredible arrogance. Because it can't be that hard. What are you talking about? It's just looking after a child and keeping them alive. It's fine.
Well, that's very magnanimous of you to kind of do that. But it must have been quite a it must have been quite a shock. It's glib, but at the time, was it a bit of a white knuckle ride?
It really was. Yeah, it really was. I had no idea of what I was letting myself in for, particularly. I had gone through a lot as a child, so I kind of had lived experience of things. So quite a lot of the stuff the teenagers come to me with, I'd done myself. So it wasn't, I wasn't surprised by behaviours or outplay of trauma and abuse, but I think I was surprised at all the other stuff that comes along with it that I had no idea about. Even silly things, that one child came, absolutely adorable little tot of an 8-year-old, and as the social worker left, I realized that her head was moving. I didn't understand why her head was moving, and I said, "What's wrong with your head?" And she said, "Oh yeah, I've got nits." I thought, "I don't know what nits are." So I took her over to our local pharmacy and was like, "What are nits?" And the pharmacist was just laughing, going, "Okay, good luck. We've got afro hair and nits. you're going to find out what they are pretty soon." So there was a lot I had to rely on my community for to educate me in what happens sometimes that I didn't know about.
I mean, I would, like you say, I would imagine you've got story after story. And I mean, the pressures of being a single foster carer, because it is a unique, it's fostering's difficult.
Yeah.
And it's stretching in lots of unusual and unique ways. But being a single carer, I think, is an added dimension. So you must have had a very strong support network around you.
Absolutely. My mum is amazing. She will be here at the drop of a hat if I need anything. And schools have always been actually really good, and friends as well. And I think you have to have that to survive. And also, I'm really into self-care. You cannot give out if you haven't filled up. So it's a non-negotiable for me. So just being able to know that you've got a community around you when you're a single carer is, you really do have to have one to make sure that you're able to keep yourself in a place where you're not going to be dysregulated. So, because it's easy to get dysregulated when you're living 24/7 with outplay of trauma. So it is hard. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's just an aside. So then we could unpick that quite a bit.
But
I'm aware as well, you said you're an NVR parenting coach. Is that how you described it? Was that the wording you used?
That's right. Non-violent resistance parenting. I fostered for maybe four years and hated myself. I was the worst. I didn't enjoy how I parented. I didn't enjoy being a foster carer, a parent. I didn't enjoy how it was. And everything that I had been taught in trainings wasn't working with my children. So, and I can't understand that. I'm also autistic. In my brain, if you tell me this is going to work, then it's going to work because you're the one with the knowledge and the education to tell me this information. But when I take home reward charts and I'm not getting anywhere with a reward chart, my child still wants to kick me in and get the reward at the end of it. And it's not working as planned. I really struggled. So I ended up speaking to a friend of mine who had done NVR training as a adoptive parent and biological parent. And she suggested I went and did it. So I went and studied just as for myself, for my foster caring, realized that it didn't change the world, but it certainly made a massive impact on how I responded to things. And that for me was what I needed. I needed to be able to respond better and be happy with how I was responding to situations. And I wasn't. Yeah. So NVR totally taught me that. And then I realized that as I was responding differently to the children or the teenagers, sometimes, quite a lot of the time, to be fair, I could notice that their behaviors and their outplays were being different. And so it is a cycle. It's a cycle of A equals B equals C equals A equals B equals C sort of thing. So there was definitely a difference and definitely something that I felt in fostering in my area anyway. They didn't offer NVR parenting, non-violent resistant parenting, as an option. So I went and trained, and the lady, Michelle Shapiro, who took the course with NVR practitioners, she had a session going for social workers and CAMs and people in that arena of what you call professionals, inverted commas, because obviously foster carers aren't professionals. Bugbear. And
it's not open that kind of worms.
Right. And so I emailed her and said, I'm an actor and a foster carer. I am not a social worker. I've never been to university to study social work or CAMs, therapies or anything, but I want to go on your course to train. So obviously there was a bit of back and forth. And in the long run, I was allowed. And so I trained with the social workers and with the CAMs and Tavistock and stuff to become a practitioner, which is what I now do as my work.
Right.
So that's how that came around. So now I work as a parenting, NVR parenting consultant for biological and adopted, no fostering so far, but biological and adopted parents. And I love it. It's amazing.
Oh, that's interesting you say no fostering, because interesting that. But I was curious as to how your supervising social worker sort of responded to you undertaking the NVR, and what was their sort of take on it?
So I think the take from fostering from child social workers and my social workers was, this is not what we do. I remember at one point, the child I had was very physical. And I ended up in hospital having to have a tetanus jab from something that had happened with the child. And I said, you know, we've got to try it. Everything we're trying doesn't work. We've got to try something new, think outside the box. And actually that was when the reward chart came in, and I was suggested that actually NVR, let's not try NVR. We don't know anything about it. Let's try a reward chart. And if it doesn't hurt you for a week, take him to Legoland.
It's a bizarre phrase, sentence. You kind of go, you just unpack even that sentence, this idea that it's not good behavior. It's just actually a basic standard of behavior that you don't hurt people, but we're going to reframe that as good behavior.
Exactly. And the whole idea of consequence as well. If you throw stuff or if you're getting hurt, take the things away, you know, and let him understand that if he does this and that, and it's like, these children don't care. They don't care if you take stuff away. Everything's been took away from them. You know, taking away his Lego isn't going to do anything different. But I need something, because I was getting so dysregulated. I was angry, if I'm honest, and I was unhappy, and I couldn't stop it. It was 24/7. Sometimes the children really do go, and when they go, they can go and go and go. There's no stop button for the outplay that they need to play out. So the NVR, actually, I said, I'm going to do it myself. So I did it myself outside of them as the parent. And then once I put it into practice and I realized it was working, I just said, this is how I'm doing it now. Like, I'm not doing the training where you tell me this is what I'm doing, because this keeps me calm and I don't care.
There's a level of self-assurance in doing that, because I think often the dynamics in foster care are that, you know, you are, I say this inverted commas, you are just the foster carer and you need to do as you're told. And I don't mean that dismissively, but to then sort of push back against what is a dominant narrative or a dominant model of behavior modification. It must have been quite, you're very bubbly and jokey about it, but it must have been a bit white knuckle.
It is. It's really white knuckle, because what you're doing is you're making a stand against something that doesn't work systemically. And when you do that, you're also fighting powers of fear, force, controlling. And there's a lot of fear, force, control in systemic organizations like social services, and I'm guessing things like teaching as well. You can gain power over people by making sure, especially for foster carers, as long as we make sure foster carers are insignificant, feel small, feel stupid, feel powerless, we're going to make sure that we've got what we need when we need it and everything else. And that's great, but that doesn't work for me, that's for sure. I don't play that game. So it was scary to a certain extent standing up, and there was resistance. But on the other hand, if you can prove something works, then you've got something on your side. If NVR completely had failed, nothing had changed, then I probably wouldn't have had the greater
outcome. You wouldn't be here talking to me today.
No.
Oh, that's fascinating then. And so you've been a foster carer for 11 years. If I can ask you, personal question, where does acting then fit into you maintaining your registration and stuff? Have you maintained your career?
No. So I had to give it up because I was a theatre actress. So you couldn't do theatre work and foster, obviously, because you couldn't work evenings. I haven't got a partner or a husband, so I didn't have anyone who could stay at home while I went off and worked. So I gave up acting, which was a regret and is a regret. And I think sometimes it's okay to have regrets. That's part of life. You're not going to win everything. It was a sad thing to give up, but it was the right thing to give up, I think, because I needed to do this and I wanted to do this. And I'd had a great acting career. I loved the shows I'd done. And it felt like it was the right time to change and move. And also, yeah. I feel like everything, the acting and the fostering, culminated together ultimately without me realizing in Hear Their Roars. So there's purpose to it, purpose to endings.
Nicely segued there. Nicely segued. before we, you've done this before, I tell you, that training is just kicking in there, so you can't even help it. So you've come to the end of your career, and it sounds like it's a positive move. You're not coming, you know, it's not precipitated by, you know, an allegation or a negative experience or you being done. It's you're moving on to something. So tell us a bit about what it's like resigning, and then what it's like moving on. What you're moving on to?
Yeah, gosh, resigning is hard. It's hard to leave anything, and it's hard to leave something where you know there's not enough foster carers anyway. Mm. And then to leave something that actually you being a foster carer is so necessary. We need them so badly. It was a lot to reconcile inside and to kind of come to terms with. But I also knew that I would always leave at some point to go and start the charity up in Africa. And that was kind of, in a way, I think we're so privileged in the UK to have so many options available to us. So even with parenting, I mean, it's quite outstanding how many parenting options we have that we can try and that we can research. And in Africa, there's none of that. There's no kind of being able to try this parenting technique or try that or have this idea or read this book sort of thing. And that's a discrepancy that I don't like. I think everybody should have the same options.
So what is the vision? Tell us the vision of the charity and kind of what is your aspiration to, what change are you trying to effect?
Brilliant. When we started in 2018, we didn't have charity registration. And I was like, we're going out to different places and we're literally just going to do sort of like, you know, summer schools for kids here, where the kids go and they have fun. And I thought, let's go to poverty areas and just bring joy. And actually that in itself is enough. And we did that in Kenya and Uganda and Sierra Leone. And it was great. But then I was like, no, this isn't right. There's something else. So when we went back to Sierra Leone, I asked everybody, the adults in the community, the elders, the teenage mums, the kids, everybody, what do you want? What is it that would add value? And everybody said they don't understand emotions and they don't understand parenting. And I thought, ooh, I do.
I mean, that sounds, I don't know. That just sounds like really strange to my ears because I think, well, you know, what does that mean? Because clearly there's a lot of parents and a lot of children and, you know, I know lots of people from different countries in Africa and their parenting's pretty okay. And it's like as good as anyone's, but so what does that mean?
Yeah. So we're working in seriously poverty stricken areas in the fifth poorest country in the world. So these areas, it's really what we used to do X amount of decades ago, corporal punishment, shaming, a lot of physical violence to get control over children. And teenagers there's a high level of pregnancy in teenagers, which means that then they don't really want these babies. So the babies get left. The babies get left in the marketplace or whatever and become street kids. And they don't know how to look after them. They don't know, you know, even little things like how to look after eyes and noses and, you know, kind of belly buttons and stuff like so. It's all too complicated. And because of Ebola, mudslides, pandemic and everything else, there's not a lot of adults. So the age is quite low in Sierra Leone.
Yeah.
So what we realized when we were out there was if I said, hey, guys, I'm going to do a little course on a bit of parenting. Do you want to come? We had so many people in the village turn up and there's just a thirst. They want to learn. They want to have ideas. They want new ideas. I was speaking to an Islamic school chief discipline officer and he wrote us a testimony.
That's a title, isn't it?
I know, right? Yeah,
tricky.
I was scared. but he said that what you're coming with could change Sierra Leone. These ideas could change Sierra Leone because we're not telling them anything. Hear Their Roar doesn't tell anybody anything. What we do is just go, can we brainstorm? Can we look at this? Can we think about things? I've learned this. Is it of value? Do you want to hear it? So it's so not a kind of charity that comes in and says, hey, we know what we're doing. Because quite frankly, I don't think we do either perfectly well. But it's just something that, hey, it's an option. Do you want to have a look at this? And through working that way, we're able to, I think, build, I think the main basis is that communities need, as well as logistics of schools and water and food, everything like that. If you are able to be regulated, which only comes from emotional intelligence, really, that's how we learn to regulate our strong emotions. If we don't know our anger or our frustration or our worry or concern, we're going to dysregulate. We're going to be reactive. So being able to teach children and young people emotional intelligence and to enable them to understand expression of their different emotions equals regulation, that's going to help them when they're adults and they've got their kids and they are teachers or they are parents. They're going to be able to regulate better. And also with the teenage mums, if they don't understand why a baby's crying, I would probably do the same. That a crying baby is exhausting, and but yeah. Be 12 and have a crying baby, you know. And so just being able to understand little things of why baby's crying and what might we can do to help this is just hopefully some ways that we're able to input into society things that they just don't have the privilege that we have of knowing these ideas. We have parenting courses, we have mother and baby courses or family courses. They don't. So that's what we're hoping to do.
I mean, that's, I was thinking about, I said before we came on, I've been down to Africa a few times to work with the project of a friend of mine, and also into Zambia where my brother lives.
Yeah.
And I think that sometimes it's difficult to express the level of poverty the absence of safeguarding that is, I mean, the first time I went to Africa, to Zambia, I wasn't a social worker, but the second time I went and I'd gone to work with a man who works with street children. And I just recall a real tangible sense of the UK norms can't be brought here.
No.
Because people are literally, you know, I was in a situation where I saw someone give a child to someone and say, well, you can feed them, so you look after them. And
you take them.
Yeah. And you kind of go, oh, hang on. Emotionally, that's like a culturally, emotionally, I'm slightly dysregulated by all of that. But actually, then to start to come in with these sort of like parochial kind of like, or patriarchal kind of like, oh, well, you know, we need to think about the four types of abuse. And we need to think about, and you go, we're somewhere else. And it's not really a question, it's just a comment. And my friend said, we were in Nairobi, and he said, oh, we've got social workers in Nairobi. And he said, and I said, well, all right, that's good. He said, we've got two.
Yeah.
And I thought about that for a second. I thought, well, hang on, that's two for a city, like a national city, the capital. And it was, you know, one for the east and one for the west. And you go, wow, where do you even start with some of this stuff? So it's interesting you talk about there being a genuine desire. And that's what I found, that people were generally looking to, everyone you talk to wants to do it better, which is really encouraging. There's no question there. That's rubbish.
No, I love that. I love that story because it's so true. And I think there's a whole load of cultural things that just because we don't do it here or we have a different perception on it, I think, can I mention breast ironing? This is one thing that I think is so interesting. Is that right? Okay. Breast ironing. In the UK, we could be horrified, absolutely horrified, and find it abusive and absolutely awful. But the reason why they do breast ironing is because when the children are old enough to start having breasts, they're old enough to be taken for sexual relationships.
Yeah.
And so the grandmothers are actually doing it as a protection. And to understand why practices are done, I think changes the whole narrative that we have on these things are so evil and so horrific and shouldn't be done. And it's like, hang on, these ladies are trying to protect their kids. And that's the way that they know, you know, that's not perpetrator. That's somebody who's really trying to save their child and in the only way they know how. So I think when we can look at practices from a kind of belief that actually people only work out of what we know, we only work out of what we know, you know, then it takes away the judgment and it takes away the idea that we know better because we don't know better. And really, I think the thing with, especially in Sierra Leone, is currently that there are situations where children are being told and empowered against things like FGM. And they're so empowered. And that's brilliant, absolutely brilliant to be empowered against FGM. I believe in that. What happens, though, is the adults aren't changing. Yeah. So these children, these girls are empowered and go home and tell dad, no, I am not having FGM. And they're half dead from a beating. So there's a difficulty when people go out to help to make sure that you can't just focus on one thing of society. You've got to look at the whole of society and actually not always start with the kids. Sometimes we have to look at different things and actually talk and communicate to elders and witch doctors and all areas of society to see what's going on and create a relationship first. And I think the thing with Hear Their Roar is that we're engaging in as much as we're trying to engage people, not because we tell them, but if a few people come along, try a little bit of MVR parenting and start realizing that they're actually less reactive with their children or understand why baby's crying. So isn't going to be so reactive. Other people are going to see that. And that creates the chain. Hear Their Roar should be not necessary in a year. Because the local people should have maybe took ideas on and doing it themselves. I want to be resigning and fired, basically. I don't want Hear Their Roar to be there forever. The whole idea of Hear Their Roar is, hey, here's what some ideas, if you like them and they work for you, take them, they're yours, and then get rid of me because you don't need me anymore. So I think the idea of a charity is never to keep it going. It's to empower people with some added value and then kind of put yourself out of a job. So not that we have a job, it's voluntarily. So I'll still be working my own work in Sierra Leone, but I'll be doing MVR parenting on Zoom from Kenema rather than Wendover. So
Well, good luck with that one.
Right.
there's limited time difference. It's all fine. I was thinking as you talking there, it sounds, I recollect my own experience was that we were trying to sort of change the culture around physically beating children. And what we were really conscious of was that you can demonstrate, you can tell people why things are wrong, but you need to give people an alternative, don't you? You need to.
Exactly.
You know, even when you're talking about the breast ironing, you actually, there's a bigger issue to be addressed. So tell me, where does Hear Their Roar come from?
So,
the name,
the name. I didn't know what to call the charity when we started or what I wanted it to be. And then I was literally sitting one day hearing a foster teenager in serious trauma. But she was crying and it wasn't a cry like I would cry nowadays if I got upset over something. It was like a guttural, came from her whole inside, sort of. And I just thought, wow, it's like a roar. It's like a roar of trauma. And that's where Hear Their Roar came from. And that the idea that trauma can be this guttural cry or it can be silent. I've had many a teenager who's never cried or given any emotional reaction to trauma. But the idea, so twofold, onefold, trauma is a roar. And if it's not going to be an emotional roar, it's going to be a behavioral roar. And secondly, we need to hear it and we need to hear children from that roar, not from their behavior. So So Hear Their Roar was kind of like a twofold idea. And then I don't know about you, but did you ever read Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe when you were younger?
I did, yes.
All right. Aslan. I loved Aslan so much. I wanted to be Lucy in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. And there's a place in one of the books, I think it's Prince Caspian, where Lucy puts her head in his mane. And it says that she got strength from that. And I thought, yeah, that's what kids need. Kids need stable, anchored adults to get their strength from, to heal from their trauma. And if we can put any tiny drop into a community where we're able to help adults become more anchored, more secure, more less reactive, and children to understand their emotions so they're able to express the trauma, because life is traumatic in Sierra Leone as well. And I've heard many people say, oh yeah, but it's just normal, so it's not the same. And oh my goodness, no, that's not it. That's shocking. It is trauma, and the adults are in trauma, and the children are in trauma, and the communities need something to get strength from. So if we can input something where they're able to find that strength from each other and learn how to connect with each other, then that's what Hear Their Roar came from. It was the kind of conception of the idea. So it's Aslan is the lion, and then Hear Their Roar is the trauma. So yeah,
I love a bit of Aslan. I love a bit of I think I did it at GCSE English.
Yeah,
no, I think it was probably GCE English. It was probably that long ago.
Are you that old?
Yeah, I was the first year of GCSEs, but I'm not bitter about that in any way whatsoever. Let's not open that can of worms. I guess, so tell me a little bit about the practicalities. So are you actually going out there and living there? Are you, and how long are you living there for?
Yeah, so we got charity commissioned in in 2020, 2 weeks before the pandemic hit.
Good timing.
Great, right? So we got a charity registration number, then the pandemic hit, which gave me 2 years to consolidate all the ideas. I was talking to people in Sierra Leone continuously, hearing what they wanted or what they thought would be possible, creating packages. And the idea is now in October, I'm taking a team of four, five, including me. And they are amazing. They're, we have SEN assistants, we have educational psychologists, we have teachers, a really great team of people who are all trauma-informed and or whatever expression you want to use for that. And we're going to go out. We've got the plan of how we're going to be working for 2 weeks really intensely in Kenema. And then they're going to leave and go home, and I'm staying out there with the intent to set up the charity legally in Kenema. So that's a whole process as well that you have to go through. So that's what I'll be doing. Then we'll be buying a building, because what I think as well, the other situation we need is we need to address street children. I think street children are so on my heart. It's just the most horrific situation to be placed in, not just for the teenage mother or the mother who's had to give the baby up because she can't do it, but also for the baby to be left on the street and grow up in the streets, which is the most dangerous place. So the idea will be to create a safe house, which is open 24/7, and that we start with the youngest, obviously, and kind of put them into the safe house and be able to feed them and look after them, any illnesses they have, help them with, and create a place where we have social workers and matrons who are able to look after these children and get them off the streets. And then if the teenagers do feel that they still need to give up their children, they can bring them to Hear Their Roar. We'll look after them. So there's a kind of twofold plan. So we'll be getting a building and getting some staff, local staff, obviously, and all of that.
It's a big
and then
step, isn't it?
It's big. It's been in the planning for a long, long time. But it does kind of feel quite huge. So I'm always thinking, just think of the small steps. Don't look at the big picture, because otherwise I'm going to get scared. But yeah, it's just a way. I think that's something I realized as well when I went there. There are lots of established charities in Sierra Leone, but the doors close. But the abuse doesn't stop. The trauma doesn't stop. It's 24/7, and the kids don't have the resources we have. You know, if a child is in an abusive situation, you know, hopefully there is somebody who's going to notice and something going to be done about it. But obviously that's not the case there. So,
Was there a question? Was there a question? Was there a specific reason you chose Sierra Leone? I mean, obviously Sierra, you can look at many countries in Africa and lots of them face very unique and specific challenges. And Sierra Leone obviously had the epidemic.
Yeah.
Pandemic of Ebola in the mid-teens, which I know is kind of just cut through the society like a scythe, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So how did you come to Sierra Leone?
We went first to Kenya and then we went to Uganda. We went to Sierra Leone a couple of times in between. And the minute I got off the plane in Sierra Leone, something happened. I felt like I was at home and I can't explain it. I don't know why. It's just a feeling I had. And then in the communities, when we were talking to people, it was Sierra Leone that everybody was saying, what can you do? Like, how do I not do this? What can I do instead? Going into the schools, caning, obviously, they have a theory that the teacher adds up in their head how tall the child is and how much the child weighs, and they can strike them three times. But the severity of the strike is an equation of how tall they are and how much they weigh. But no teacher who's dysregulated is going to do that equation. They're going to beat the baloney out, you know. So we went into schools and when we were talking about caning or just asking about it and like, you know, how does it work? Does it work? No, it doesn't work, apparently. All the teachers are like, no, they still are naughty. What should we do then?
People are the same the world over, aren't they?
Right. Yeah. So looking at things like that, I realized that actually this was a community that wanted to talk and wanted to ask me and us as the team, ask us how we did things. What's the difference with our kids and their kids? What's the difference in the disciplining or the control, as they would say it? How does it work? And I thought, you know what? This is a country that's so young and is wanting to look at options and look at ideas. And that just really filled me with, this is, I think, somewhere that can really take value from this. Yeah.
Wow. So if people wanted to find out more, where should they go?
So we have a website, which is www.heartheirroar.org, or all over social media. But I'm pretty rubbish on Twitter, so it's more Instagram and Facebook, I think, for anything valuable. But Instagram, Twitter, Facebook is at Hear Their Roar. But yeah, it would be great to connect to anybody. That would be awesome.
That would be wonderful. And I can see your website, and your website's got, you know, it's got lots of information and some, you know, really good pictures and sort of testimonials and past work that you've done and some famous faces on there as well. So that's
excellent. I think there might be one,
There might be one or two. Megan, it's been absolutely fantastic chatting to you. And perhaps when will you be back in the UK?
Well, I'll only have a 3-month visa to start off with. So I'll have to be back come January to get the permanent one to go out. So January.
Well, it'd be lovely to find out how you're getting on. I mean, I suppose we don't need to be in the same country, do we?
No.
You could just do it by Zoom. So we'll just...
Right. We could Zoom it from the safe house.
Terribly modern world we live in. My brother moved to Africa in the 2000s. We used to send each other a letter once a year and maybe we would get it, and now I can literally I can WhatsApp him.
What's
and
that?
he's in the bush. He's 1,000 miles from the nearest road. It's like,
brilliant.
World's moved on.
It really has.
Excellent. So Megan, thank you so much, and I really wish you well with your project, because I think that it's clear that you don't have a sort of, you're not like a colonial going over there to change the world. You do want to change the world, but you want to do it with a generous and collaborative spirit, which is encouraging.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I've loved chatting to you. It's been so much fun.
There's so much more we could have talked about, isn't there? About lots of different things. But maybe we'll get you back on and we'll do that.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, look after yourself.
I'd love that. And, absolutely. Anytime.
Excellent. Well, that we'll make it a date. Okay, so look after yourself and we'll speak to you soon.
Brilliant. All right, see you later.